Beyond the headlines, this is World Insight.
Hello, I'm Tian Wei, and welcome to World Insight. China's economic performance this year has witnessed a strong start, with its total physical imports and exports expanding 5% year-on-year in the first quarter. Global investors continue to view China as a favored investment destination despite a challenging and complex external environment. One of the investors is U.S., whose trade interactions with China remain resilient despite bumpy bilateral relations. How should we understand the significance of economic and trade cooperation between China and the U.S.? What are the expectations from the business communities from both sides? And what can one expect in the future relation? On these and more, I talked to Sean Stein, chairman of the Board of Governors of the American Chamber of Commerce in China. On the day of the interview, the AmCham just put out its annual white paper regarding investment and business environment in China and its suggestions to policymakers from both sides. Mr. Stein, now, what do you see is the most important issues the American business communities in China are looking at?
Well, there's two kinds of issues. The most important issue, if you ask our members for the last 4 years, is the state of the U.S.-China relationship. And our members are happy that over the last year, the two countries have taken steps to stabilize the relationship. So that's very good. So that's one part. But the other part is the regulatory environment that's increasingly complex that affects everybody. So those are the two most important issues, regulation and the state of the bilateral relationship.
When they see the relationship as stabilizing, what are they referring to?
So what they're referring to is that we saw starting a little over a year ago, we saw the relationship between the U.S. and China was becoming more and more tense. So we were very happy to see that the two countries sort of agreed that that kind of relationship, I mean, the two largest economies in the world, you cannot have a situation where the relationship continues to deteriorate and each one has to act and react. So we were very pleased that the two governments took steps to stabilize it. And I think both countries get a lot of credit. I mean, we saw on the U.S. side, we saw a year ago, we saw Tony Blinken came, the Secretary of State, followed immediately by Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, followed by Gina Raimondo. And then we saw a similar commitment from the Chinese side last November when President Xi Jinping went to San Francisco, met with Biden at Woodside. Important decisions came out of that, and then met with the business community. So the two countries took steps to stabilize it. And so I think that's created a little more optimism on the part of the business community. So those are the things that I think really helped drive it forward.
The meeting between the two presidents during the on the sideline of the APEC economic leaders meeting is extremely important, but many also wonder not only the significance of that meeting, but the implementation of the principles agreed by the two heads of state during the meeting. How do you see the implementation so far, especially this is an election year in the U.S.?
So I think that what we see is a couple of things that are important. The first is they did succeed in stabilizing the relationship. But what they didn't succeed in doing is there's some really deep divisions between the U.S. and China on a lot of things, on export controls, on geopolitics. There's a lot of things that divide the two countries. And agreeing to create dialogues and have new channels to communicate is good, and it helps bring stability. But that in and of itself doesn't solve the underlying problems. And so I think that what we're hopeful is that over time, some of those problems can be resolved. But places where I think it's been somewhat positive, I think the U.S. government has definitely given more information to the Chinese government about issues of concern that lead them to do export controls and sanctions. So I think there's been good implementation, at least on information sharing on the U.S. side. And the sense I get is the U.S. has been very pleased with implementation on the agreement on fentanyl. So I think both sides have given a bit, but really the underlying issues are there. And that's why I say they brought stability to the relationship. And the hope would be that over the next year or longer, they could find ways to build on that stability and move things to a better place. But I don't think they're there yet.
The interests of the business communities from both sides are very intertwined. However, as Mr. Stein, you pointed out earlier, this process of settling down on both the nature and the details of the bilateral relations will likely to last for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So from your perspective as the chairman of AmCham in China, what would be the best strategies for business communities on both sides to go through this tunnel before seeing the eventual light at the end of it?
Well, I think that where we are now, I think that what I'm telling businesses and what we're seeing from our members is our members feel like things are better than they were and things are more stable, but there's not this expectation that it's going to get dramatically better soon. It's going to be a very incremental process for the relationship to improve. And so what we're telling our members and what we're seeing is effective is both governments have got concerns. And increasingly what companies have to do is they have to look at the areas where the US government will allow them to operate and see where that overlaps where the Chinese government will allow them to operate, and then walk on this narrow path that allows them to take into account issues of concern on the American side and on the Chinese side. And for many companies, that's very challenging to do. Imagine if you're in semiconductors, or if you're in biotech, or aviation, or areas where both countries feel like they have an interest that may even be a national security interest. That's really hard, and it takes some really deft work by the companies to navigate that.
How do you work with your members in order to solicit opinions and ways of communications with the political leaders and relevant organizations to narrow down and to make it specific?
Yeah, so I think most of our discussion, I wouldn't say is with political leaders. Our discussion is really with the technocratic regulators. And because the technocratic regulators, whether they're in the United States or in China, recognize the value of having US business here. And so what we try and do is we try and look at each industry and have those industries identify what are the real impediments and what would need to change if there was going to be more investment or a more fair business climate. And they do that on the US side and on the Chinese side. So in our white paper, we've got recommendations for both governments. It's not just for the American government, not just for the Chinese government. So that's the first part. But the second is we bring together many, many members. We had over 100 member companies involved in this process to identify what are the key issues that would make sense for the two governments. And then the members themselves work to build consensus and then to draft recommendations and to issue a scorecard. So when we say we're the voice of American business, really, this white paper is truly the voice of American business. And between us, I'll tell you, I hear from European companies and Japanese companies, and they say, you're our voice as well.
We see the US companies are doing not only their businesses here in the Chinese market, but also using China as a manufacturing base, a research base, and several other functions to provide products to their home market in the US and also to markets elsewhere. So we see a combination of these. So how do you see the US businesses, you know, with a combination of all of these functions, think about the best way to communicate with Washington?
Yeah, so I think one of the really important lessons that our companies learned and that Chinese companies learned is, you know, during COVID, everybody realized just how vulnerable supply chains can be, and everybody suffered, and everybody realized supply chains needed to be more resilient. And so one of the messages that we have for Washington is Washington is rightly concerned about supply chains. Well, guess what? So are we. So is the business community. We're the ones who felt it long before the US consumer did, long before it was even recognized by the US government. And so one of the important messages is to say we share the concerns of the US government and we have ways to get there. And so I think that's one important tool. The second, though, is that one of the really important ways that US business is involved in China is in R&D. There are companies that don't even do business in China, but that have R&D here because there are many highly qualified Chinese workers, STEM workers, STEM trained engineers, et cetera, and that if American companies are going to be competitive globally, they need to be able to take advantage of the best research available anywhere on the planet and the best workers anywhere on the planet. In some cases, to be globally competitive, it means they need to be in China. And so in an era of strategic competition, as the US government says, and maybe it is an era of strategic competition, that part of the US strategy for that needs to be to have American companies competing in China. And in many cases, that's going to include doing research and development and other things here, because we need to be able to compete with peers all over the planet, not just at home, not just in China.
So how would you raise the awareness of the politicians, you know, when you are doing the door knock, especially when the geopolitics and the so-called political correctness is blowing the wind to a very different direction?
So when we go to Washington, it's obviously not every member that wants to meet with us. But the members who do want to meet with us and who do agree to meet with us do because they genuinely want to better understand what's happening on the ground. People who've already made up their mind have got no reason to see us. People who have fixed views don't actually want to hear different opinions. So the people who meet with us, even though at the end of the day, even if they don't agree with us, they want to hear what we have to say because they value having voices who've been on the ground, who've been working in China and doing business in China, because they think that helps them do their job better. So it doesn't mean we persuade everybody, but we do have a respectful dialogue. I think it's helpful even to those who don't agree at the end of the day with our message. It does help them have at least a broader understanding of what it's really like in China and what's really happening on the ground.
On the other hand, this is an election year, as we said, in the United States. So how do you prepare for the worst scenario? We remember years ago, there was a dramatic change of the trade policies toward China, for example. Mm-hmm. And then business committees from both sides got hurt. And now we see the unpredictability is once again very high, not just for this year, but also for the years to follow. Yeah. So how do you and your other colleagues from the American Business Committee here in China look at those possibilities and plan?
So I think what we're seeing is we're seeing that a number of companies are looking at where we are now in the relationship. And they recognize that the Biden administration wants to keep this stability, just like the Chinese government wants to keep the stability. And so I think they're trying to move ahead with projects and other things right now while the situation is stable and predictable. Because at the end of the day, none of us know what's going to happen after the third Tuesday of 2025 in January. And so people are trying to get done what they can do now. But irrespective of the outcome of the election, the American Chamber's position isn't going to change. And the position is that investment by Chinese companies in the United States is good. And investment by U.S. companies in China is good and helps both countries. And that more trade, as long as it doesn't affect anybody's national security, is also good. And that for the governments, that having equal application of the law to all, American and Chinese, or in China, Chinese and American, and transparency is good for everyone. And finally, there should be dialogue. And the two governments, no matter what the disagreements are, need to be able to talk. And so that's what we tell the Biden administration. And if there's a Trump administration, that's what we will tell them as well. Our position isn't going to change just because there's a change in the U.S. government or U.S. administration.
There are concerns about few and fewer Americans in China.
Yes.
And now we see some students, American students, even though very slowly, are coming back to study here in China, in some of the most prestigious universities in China, for example. But the people-to-people exchanges still need a better momentum.
Yeah.
You've been living here on and off in China for 25 years. Mm-hmm. So, Sean, you know what it was like when people-to-people relations was at its highest days.
Yeah.
So how does business community in China from the U.S. try to cultivate this atmosphere and bring more practical support to this movement?
Yeah, well, I gotta tell you something that I think will surprise you, or at least it'll surprise a lot of people, and that is, despite the tension between the two countries, we've been working, for example, with a foundation called the Helen Foster Snow Foundation. Mm-hmm. I only mention that because they were invited by President Xi
yes.
to attend the event in San Francisco. And they've set up a program which is going to bring American middle school students to China over the summer. And they thought they should start modestly with maybe 100 or 150 American students to come over. And what they found is as they've talked to parents and talked to students and to schools saying, you know, will you pay to bring your child and let us do a summer camp with them in China? What they found is that the demand has been overwhelming.
Wow.
So what hasn't changed is Americans are fascinated with China. And Americans feel a real affinity for China. And the proof is, despite the level of tension and difficulty between the two governments, we have the small foundation in the United States creating a program where for American students to come, and they have more American students wanting to sign up than they can possibly accommodate in the first year. So that's what gives me hope that at the end of the day, there will be political differences and geopolitics will divide the countries. Differences over trade policy will strain the relationship. But at the end of the day, Americans like China and they like the Chinese people and they want their children to understand China. So I think the people-to-people initiatives are really important. And even though we'll never get to maybe you know, where I think we've got 300,000 Chinese students in the United States. We're never going to get that close on the U.S. side coming to China. But everything we can do to have more Americans come to China and see for themselves, I think the better it is for the world and better it is for the relationship.
What would be the advice you would give to them if you're meeting them in China, you know, when they just arrive in China?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the biggest frustration. So in my role in my day job and in my role at AmCham, a week does not go by when I don't have an American company calling and saying, we want to send our CEO, we want to send our senior leadership. Is it safe? And of course, they don't want a yes or a no. They want an analysis. They want a discussion. And so we talk through them about what are the risks and where would the risks be. And in 99.99% of the time, we're like, of course it's safe, and come. And then I tell them that even my own daughter is coming to study in China. And if it wasn't safe, I wouldn't have my daughter here. So that's the advice.
That's the most persuasive advice, I guess.
Right. But the most important then is that I think, you know, in both countries, it's very easy to get a distorted view of the other country if all you're doing is reading social media or even traditional media, and that there is no substitute for coming and seeing for yourself. So that's my advice, is come yourself, send your children, send your CEO, send your board members, but they need to come and see for themselves. Otherwise, they will not understand the opportunities and they won't understand the challenges.
Sean, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed it thoroughly. Thank you very much.
Coming up, my conversation with a U.S. scholar on how to deepen the interactions and communications between the two sides, especially academic exchanges.
Ever wondered what's actually going on in Africa through the perspective of an African? How are things really going between China and Africa? What's the narrative of this relationship? Well, get a perspective with China-Africa Talk. Hear from African diplomats, entrepreneurs, academics, Chinese natives, and more. Get on our wavelength every week to find out what's real with China-Africa Talk. Find us on your favorite podcast. We'll see you there.
Discover the realities and responses to our changing climate with Climate Watch. Uncover critical issues such as the Masai Mara's disrupted wildebeest migration and the drop in the Panama Canal's water levels. Delve into solutions for a sustainable future. Tune in to Climate Watch on your favorite podcast platform. Become more eco-conscious and take action to protect our planet.
This is World Insight. I'm Tian Wei. This year marks the 45th anniversary of diplomatic relations between China and the U.S. Looking back, the two countries had their ups and downs along the way, yet people-to-people exchanges remain resilient despite the tensions. People in academia, for example, have been in touch with one another. Scott Kennedy from the Center for Strategic and International Studies is one active promoter of the two-way communications. He was the first to lead an academic delegation to China after the pandemic. I had a talk with him about his latest article and also his urge to increase interactions between the two sides, people-to-people communications. The U.S.-China relations does play a critical role,
sure,
not only for China, but also for everyone. So leading up to the election, it's a very tricky time. I know the U.S. are pretty much buried in their domestic issues, but how do you see the relations between the two countries likely to tangle leading up to the election?
U.S. elections, in the heat of the battle, a lot of things are discussed, but that's still different from what policy is made.
Right.
And I think Chinese have long learned the lesson that you shouldn't overestimate the significance of what's said during a campaign, mm-hmm, and wait until someone takes office. Also, even though China's important in the global economy, it is obviously central to how the U.S. now thinks about its foreign policy and national security, and people are deeply worried about the direction of China and the relationship. So far, China has never been an issue which has affected the outcome of a presidential election or just about any congressional race that I've ever heard of. So we're going to hear a lot of chatter, a lot of talk, mostly about China as a symbol of to what extent American politicians are defending the U.S. national interest. The whole American conversation about China, it's really about, to some extent, what kind of relationship do people think the U.S. could have with China long term? Can we coexist? That's one question. And then what are the right tactics or strategy that the U.S. ought to use to see if they can coexist with China and have that be a stable relationship? Some cooperation, some competition, hopefully no conflict. I think all of us have to wait really until January of 2025 to see who comes into office, both in the presidency and in Congress, to know what American policy is actually going to be.
There is already existing tremendous investment of the U.S. businesses in China, vice versa. We also see there is also enthusiasm still into the different both directions, both traffic.
Sure.
But their pressure is coming from politics. There is legislation, also limitations. So how legal limitations. So how do you see that likely to play it out? Do you see it getting ever tighter, or there is likely to be maneuvering space as a result of dialogue possibilities?
So U.S. investment in China has slowed down significantly. There's still lots of Fortune 500 companies here, small, medium-sized American companies. And as we've heard at this conference, some of those companies are expanding their investment. There is significant global anxiety about investing in China, in part because of U.S.-China geostrategic tensions, but also the environment in China, the uncertainty about the trajectory of policy, when you'll see a strong economic rebound. And so both because of geostrategic concerns and the domestic environment, foreign investment hasn't continued to rise as it had in the past. And so the way to get a rebound in investment, you actually don't need to change any laws or regulations. You just have to change the broader environment. So that means increasing U.S.-China trust on high tech, on issues related to industrial policy and national security, and improving the domestic economic climate.
Scott, you are one of the leading scholars from both sides to make the very first academic exchanges by bringing a delegation of American intellectuals to China. At that time, there was no one breaking the ice. You were the one. What about the current stage of academic exchanges between the two sides?
On the upside, in the spring of 2024, things are a lot better than they were in the spring of 2022, when nobody was here. But after 2 years, we have seen the renewal of exchanges between professors in both countries, scholars doing field work, visiting in the other country, the renewal of students. I was just down in Nanjing, and there are a lot more American students studying at the Hopkins Nanjing Center, a place I went to school 30 years ago. It's nice to see. Found my picture on the wall, very grainy. I was like, wow, what an old, oh my God, that's a very different era. But the place is still there, it's still thriving. The mission of scholarly cooperation is still alive and well, but there's still significant challenges. There's been an over-securitization of the relationship, which has had an effect on scholarly cooperation. And so even though scholars and students have returned, they've not returned in the numbers that they were before. And in both places, students and scholars are facing a variety of obstacles. Just in terms of basic travel, not only are airline tickets still too expensive, but when you get to the airports, particularly for Chinese arriving in American airports, they still occasionally get harassed. They get a visa, but then from the State Department, but the Department of Homeland Security didn't get that memo, and they have a different view when people arrive. And of course, they have different responsibilities in the State Department, but that has led to some tensions, and we really need to get all of the U.S. government on the same page. So if someone gets a visa, they are welcomed with open arms. Americans, when they're here in China, they usually don't face challenges at the airport. They face challenges after they leave the airport. It's a more complex environment in China in which to do field work, to travel around the country. There's no rules that block you from traveling and meeting people, but there's anxieties from universities, think tanks, people that you might potentially need to interview, or collaborators on collecting data. As a result of those things, people are worried, and so the numbers haven't risen to where they need to be. I know that President Xi Jinping has set this goal of 50,000 Americans visiting China. There's gonna be a variety of things that will need to be done, both by the United States and China, to meet that goal. It's a very, very ambitious goal. I hope there's success in achieving those numbers, but that will mean that a variety of changes have taken place to increase trust on both sides so that you do get more people traveling both ways.
Scott Kennedy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei on behalf of the team. Thanks for being with us. Bye for now.